This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, it's now the largest act of civil disobedience in Canadian history.
Oh, that we could have such a revolt in the streets here in America. A tuition raise of less than $300 causes a 250,000 people to hit the streets in Montreal.
In the first of a two-part interview, we'll get the background leading up to the recent elections in Greece.
Elections brought about because of the imposed austerity by the European Union on the people of Greece. Many of the people in Greece are in revolt.
We'll talk with Martin Garbus, the new attorney on the case of the Cuban Five.
Does it sound right that, unknown to the defense, that the United States government was paying journalists for major newspapers who covered the trial? You can imagine how they covered it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, the National Lawyers Guild attorneys had a big victory in defending the Occupy people just last week. Tell us about it.
Well, Michael, actually, attorneys who are guild members from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund in D.C., got a ruling from a federal judge saying that police did not adequately warn the Occupy Wall Street protesters against walking on the roadway of the Brooklyn Bridge before they trapped and arrested about 700 of them in October.
People may remember this. I was around then, and I got calls from friends on the bridge that said, Michael, we're about to be arrested. We were never warned. We just came on the bridge with everybody else. I didn't come here to be arrested. I came here just to go on the Occupy March. And what the cops did was they just cut off both ends of the bridges and they arrested 700 people in what's, I guess it's called kettling. It's getting people into a kettle. So it was a major action by the cops. Some people think it was an effort to simply get information about everybody who was going to be an Occupy person and get them recorded in the police database. But here you had all these young people who just went on a march and were then kettled into the bridge. But so there was a lawsuit brought, Heidi. That's what you're here to tell us
exactly
about.
And the issue was whether this could proceed as a class action. And Judge Jed Rakoff said it could. He basically addressed one of the most contentious issues that came out of the protest, and that was, did the police wrongfully arrest hundreds of protesters by allowing them or even leading them on the rock roadway because the police were in front of them? And then they surrounded them with their orange netting, as they've been doing for years. The city contended that the protesters left the pedestrian walkway for the roadway, knowing full well they could be arrested. But Judge Rakoff held in favor of the protesters and found that a reasonable officer in a noisy environment would have known that one single bullhorn, which is what they used, could not reasonably communicate a message to 700 demonstrators.
700 demonstrators, which probably went back a half a mile.
So you have
this one bullhorn. And then I think the judge went on to say that not only is it obvious people didn't hear any warning, which is the people who called me contemporaneously as they were being arrested said we didn't hear any warning, but in addition, he said the way the cops led the march, they were on the pedestrian walkway, and then the cops in front of everybody actually walked onto the roadway.
Exactly.
And people followed the cops thinking that's where they ought to go.
Right. And can I say that before that, and this was also mentioned in the lawsuit and in the judge's opinion, the police, before they got onto the bridge, actually led the marchers through like red lights so that it really gave the impression that police were taking them on a little walk and they had permission to do so.
A massive entrapment. What's the significance of getting class certification?
The significance is that you don't have to go case by case to prove that you were entrapped into going onto the bridge. But he's saying everybody who was on that bridge and was arrested essentially has a class damage case against the police, and he could award first an injunctive relief against it happening again, but class-wide damages and give a per-person damage without hearing individual cases. Otherwise, if there was no class action, you'd have to individually bring every single case, have the person testify, didn't hear the warning, and then have them decide whether you heard it or not and whether you followed the person. So instead of having 700 cases, you probably have a dozen cases that will be representative of the whole class, and then class-wide damages can be awarded. It's a big deal. And it may also result in new regulations for how the police can do these kinds of things.
The
Michael, there were three big executive power decisions that came down last week. Let's talk about those. What about the Boumediene case?
Well, you know, as listeners know, we've been covering Guantanamo here almost since the beginning of our show. The Center for Constitutional Rights was deeply involved in the earliest cases on Guantanamo, the first organization, and we won the case called Razul in 2004, which gave the Guantanamo detainees the right to file writs of habeas corpus to test their detention at Guantanamo. It took four more years to get that decision embodied in a decision called Boumediene in the Supreme Court that said that it's actually a constitutional right, not just a statutory right. And then from 2008 until today, we've tried to get through habeas corpus, people testing their detention, we've tried to get the remaining people released from Guantanamo. To give an overall picture, there's been three Supreme Court decisions. We have a clear Supreme Court decision in Boumediene in 2008 saying that people at Guantanamo should be given a meaningful opportunity to test their detention. The problem is, as the habeas corpus attorneys, many from the center and other law firms around the country, have gone into the federal district court, the lowest court in Washington, they have been winning the cases. That's not the problem. They've been winning on the basis that the government didn't have sufficient evidence to hold people as, quote, enemy combatants, that the, quote, intelligence they had on people was not meaningful, was not significant, and that there were alternative theories why various people were in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Unfortunately, every one of those cases in which there's been a victory, or almost every one, that the government has then appealed to the middle court, the Court of Appeals in Washington, has been either reversed, which is to say the person will not be released, or has been sent back to the district court for reconsideration. So what you have is a very hostile District of Columbia Circuit, which admittedly and openly has said, we don't agree with the Boumediene case. We don't like the Supreme Court case. It's contrary to what we think. Now, of course, you would think that these people are middle-level appellate judges. They're important, but they're not as important as the Supreme Court, and they shouldn't be able to counter or go against what the Supreme Court had said in 2008. So this year, finally, a week ago, in front of the Supreme Court were seven cases coming out of the D.C. Court of Appeals, the Circuit Court, saying to the Supreme Court, on behalf of our clients, the Guantanamo detainees, saying the appeals court has misread what you've done in the Supreme Court. They've disregarded what you've done in the Supreme Court. The appeals court hasn't given a meaningful opportunity to our clients, and they've reversed all of our victories. Supreme Court, please, in your capacity of having ruled in our favor in the Boumediene case and in seeing that that decision is carried out correctly, please reconsider these cases and tell the circuit it has to start obeying the Supreme Court. We weren't sure, but we were hopeful that the Supreme Court would take on those cases and slap the hands of the circuit court, which has really left rotting, along with the Obama administration, has left rotting 170 people at Guantanamo. Unfortunately and sadly, the Supreme Court denied review of those circuit cases, all seven of them. That is very significant because what it means, if you look at it broadly, is that the cases are over. Not just those seven, but the habeas cases for the 170 people left in Guantanamo are essentially done. That we had a run of, maybe since 2004, maybe since 2008, of habeas cases in which we were able, through pressure, through opening up Guantanamo, through getting lawyers there, to free hundreds of people. But now we've really reached the end, as many of our habeas counsel think, of that litigation. The door is closed. The Supreme Court has let the D.C. Circuit Court, probably the most important appeals court in the country, get away with undercutting Supreme Court rulings. And it means it's over. So we've been debating a lot within our legal group, what does this mean? Well, it's most obvious it means that the habeas cases are over and that to get the people out of Guantanamo, we're going to have to come up with other means of pressure, public and otherwise, to try and close that institution when we at this point know we have the Obama administration not in favor of that. We have a Justice Department that keeps putting in briefs saying these people can't be released. We have courts that aren't willing to review it. And we have Congress, which is to the right of even them, basically saying, let's put them in there forever. Let's put Americans in there. Let's do whatever. We've reached the end of really a 10 or 11 year road of litigation. How do we all feel about it? Look, most of us feel
quite good that we actually were able to release so many people and get spotlight attention on them and get the torture regime ended. But in fact, it's really saying that the executive, and that's why when Michael Smith opened this question to me, he said this is about executive power, and that's correct. This says the executive can put people at Guantanamo, and essentially, while we have an abstraction of the right to review by habeas corpus, a right to review the detention, we in fact don't have any real review of people, and I don't have any way legally any longer, I don't think, of closing, or none of us do, of closing Guantanamo.
Continuing with the theme of executive power, Michael, there were two other cases, the Garcia case and the Padilla case.
Well, let's talk about Padilla first, because Padilla is, in a sense, another Supreme Court denial, and it's related to Guantanamo. Padilla case, if our listeners may remember, was a guy, a U.S. citizen, who got off a plane in Chicago, and they arrested him as he got off the plane. Arrested is a funny word to use. They captured him as he got off the plane and stuck him into 4 years of detention in the United States as an enemy combatant. And he was abused during that period, many would argue tortured during that period, as his lawyers did, and he has now been convicted of a separate crime. He was taken, as the enemy combatant case was eventually, as it was reaching the Supreme Court a few years ago, the government indicted him and convicted him of something else. But while he was an enemy combatant, he was tortured. And so now, what the Supreme Court recently turned down review of was a case brought by Padilla and his mother against various U.S. government officials for a declaration saying that the way he was treated was unconstitutional. He only asked for $1 in damages and a declaration that he shouldn't have been abused, treated cruel and inhumanely, and tortured while he was in detention. And the circuit court, a different circuit court than the D.C. circuit, but the circuit court ruled that he had no right to sue for the dollar damages or to get an injunction against the conduct that he underwent when he was kept as an enemy combatant as a U.S. citizen in the United States for 4 years. The Supreme Court said we're not going to review that decision. Heidi?
Michael, what was the basis for the circuit court saying that he couldn't? Was it a standing issue?
It's disgusting, I'll tell you. I read that thing. You know, obviously, had he been held as a criminal defendant for 4 years, you couldn't have done any of this stuff. He would have had not just Miranda rights, but you couldn't lay a finger on the guy. You couldn't deprive him of light and air and all kinds of things. You couldn't keep him in an underground cell. All the abuse that this guy suffered, you couldn't touch him. And then you would have been able to bring a damage case. What the court said was completely bizarre to me. It said, well, he was designated as a, quote, enemy combatant. And it's not clear that the people who were running the prison or the people, officials like Rumsfeld and others who had him detained, knew that you couldn't treat an enemy combatant with abuse. Now, that seems crazy. So if they had designated the guy to be a tropical fish, does that mean that they could abuse the guy? It's,
well,
crazy.
It's sort of like being designated a prisoner of war, isn't it? And then wouldn't he be subject to the Geneva Conventions and
had they designated him as a prisoner of war, he couldn't be touched either. So he couldn't have been touched as a criminal defendant. He couldn't be touched as a prisoner of war. But instead, because Bush and company and now Obama made up a term, enemy combatant, to treat people, the court says, well, it was unclear to the people who abused him what the rules were for how you treat enemy combatants. So in other words, they made up a category, and then they said the rules are unclear. Let's start from saying a person is in prison, whether a prisoner of war, an enemy, a combatant, or if you call them a tropical fish. They're human beings, and how can you abuse them? So the court decision was just off the wall, and the Supreme Court turned down review. So again, going back to Michael Smith's theme of executive power, it's saying essentially Supreme Court can designate someone as anything they want, in this case an enemy combatant, and then they can claim that there's no rules protecting that person from abuse and torture because that designation has never been used before, and then they can abuse him, and then the executive can't be sued for doing that, even for an injunction against doing it.
So, Michael, if I understand this correctly, that with the Supreme Court's declining to review it, the government now has a blank check to do whatever it wants to an American citizen. To date, not one person has been called into court to account for that.
I think that last point is really important. We have at the center and other organizations have probably, I can't even mention, it might be 20, 30 cases in which we've claimed abuse and direct torture. Maher Arar, the Canadian, of course, who was taken off the plane, sent to Kennedy, sent to Syria for torture.
was dismissed as well. We have not had one successful case of probably 20 or 30 cases in which the torture is confirmed. Not one case in which any court has been willing to give any relief on behalf of any of our clients. It's a horrible, horrible record.
Michael, to add on to this executive power catastrophe, talk to us about the Garcia case.
Well, it's a case called Garcia v. Thomas. Garcia is a person who is supposed to be sent to the Philippines for a trial. And he asserted that if he's sent to the Philippines, as his other five co-defendants were, other four co-defendants, that it's more likely than not that he would be tortured. And therefore, he should not be sent to the Philippines. And the court conceded, for purposes of the case, that the other defendants in his case had been tortured in the Philippines. And so they brought this case to say that he should not be sent. Now, there is a convention against torture that the United States signed and ratified that says you cannot be sent to a country where it's more likely than not that you'll be tortured, or where there's a substantial likelihood that you'll be tortured. What happens under the regulations that were set up under the Convention Against Torture is the Department of State, in the person of Hillary Clinton, has to certify that it is not likely or less, it is not more likely than not that you'll be tortured. So what happens in this case, if the State Department certifies that someone can be sent to the Philippines despite their claims that they'll be tortured, can that certification by the State Department be tested by a court? In other words, Ken Garcia come in and said that, look it, my four co-defendants were sent to the Philippines. Every one of them was tortured. Can Hillary Clinton then certify that it's not likely that I'll be tortured if I'll go to the Philippines? Yes, she can certify that, but can't I test that in court? And what the court said was once the Secretary of State signs a piece of paper saying that it's not likely this person will be tortured, that's the end of the matter. All you can go to court for is to make sure, in this case, she, Hillary Clinton, has signed the paper that says that I can be sent there and I won't be tortured. You can't do anything to bring in outside evidence that says Philippines routinely torture people who are sent to this prison. They've even tortured my co-defendants. So again, going back to your theme of executive power, it's saying that the executive, when it comes to enforcing the prohibition on torture, you have to accept what the executive says. You can't go to court and say the executive is lying, the executive is wrong, the evidence is 100% that I'll be tortured. So this is not just about the Philippines. This is about every person we send to another country, whether that country is Syria, China, wherever it is. If the Secretary of State says, get rid of them, that's the end of the matter.
Social unrest in Montreal continues unabated, with nightly demonstrations as thousands fill the streets in what is now the largest civil disobedience movement in Canadian history. Protests against tuition hikes and austerity are evolving into community assemblies and also into increasingly popular pots and pans protests. In response, police are randomly searching and detaining people wearing the red square in solidarity with the movement and trying to break up each emergent protest. For an update on student protests, we're joined by Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, a member of CLAS, a coalition of striking student unions. Welcome, Gabrielle, to Law and Disorder.
Hi.
Gabrielle, we've been following with a great degree of incitement and enthusiasm what's been going on in Quebec, the largest student strike in the history of North America. You've already organized the single biggest civil disobedience action in Canadian history. Tell us what kind of support Class A is getting and what your demands are.
Well, the strike actually started on the specific issue of an increase of tuition fees that was announced by the government here, an increase of 75% over 5 years. The strike started at the beginning of February, and now the strike is still going on. And what we can say is that after a few weeks of strike, the debate around the tuition increase was included in a much larger debate about neoliberalism, about the privatization of the public services. And what we can say is that right now, if it started as a student strike, it is now a popular movement.
How were you able to do that? What kind of demands did you make? How were you able to bring in community support past the student body?
I, I think, you know, there's no magic recipe, but I think the context in Quebec explains a lot of the reasons why we have been able to build such a movement. There has been so much insatisfaction that was accumulated against the Charest government in the last maybe 10 years that when our strike began, a lot of citizens, a lot of workers saw in our movement an opportunity to mobilize, an opportunity to go in the street, because a lot of people were very angry about the general direction that was taking Quebec since 10 years, but had no opportunity to go and express it in the streets. And when students, when the young people began to be every day of in the streets of Montreal and of Quebec, we have seen a lot of citizens, you know, kind of saying, oh, we were waiting for something to demonstrate, and then more and more we see citizens with us in the streets.
We all read about here in New York, we read about, and in the U.S., this something called Bill 78. And, you know, we followed the student protests, and then there was some kind of Bill 78 passed, and then your numbers just seem to increase dramatically. What is Bill 78, and what's happening with that?
Bill 78 is a special law that was adopted by the government in urgency. This law has three major sections. The first section of the law suspends the winter semester, and the objective of this suspension was to stop the student strike. So the semesters are now suspended. We are in sort of a lockout these days, and the winter semester will start again at the middle of August. So that's the first section. It's about the calendar of the universities. The second section of the Bill 78 is about the right of strike of the students. This bill says, in fact, that no one has the right to hold a picket line in front of an education institution. And there are very, very high fines that are associated to breaking this interdiction of picket lines. So we're talking essentially for an individual, it can go to $50,000, but for an organization or a national student organizer, we're talking about $125,000 for each infraction. And the third part of this bill is a really strict view of the right to protest. So, for example, in the law, it's written that if you want to organize a protest, you have to tell it to the police 8 hours before. You have to give your itinerary. You have to say how many people you expect to your protest. And this law gives also to the police the power change the route of your protest if they are not happy with it. The main objective of the bill, in fact, is to break the mobilization. And that was said exactly like that by the Prime Minister of Quebec when he put the project of law on the table at the National Assembly. So obviously, when this law was adopted, what we saw was not a suspension of the mobilization. In fact, we saw the exact opposite. We saw hundreds of thousands of persons, of citizens, going out in the street, not only of Montreal, but of all the cities of Quebec, every night with their pots and pans banging on it to express their anger against this special law. And we have seen literally thousands of illegal protests, of civil disobedience protests in the streets of the province.
Gabrielle, that leads into what I wanted to ask you, which is we hear that police are conducting searches and detaining people who wear the red square in solidarity with the movement. We've also heard about police treatment of protesters at the G8 and G20 summit 2 years ago, a scathing report released a month or two ago. How are the police acting now?
This one of the main characteristics of the strike was that we saw that when the government decided to break the negotiations with us, with the representatives of the student movement, we saw in parallel to that the police being more and more repressive in the streets. So, for example, like you said, last weekend in Montreal, there were hundreds of policemen everywhere in the subway stations who were systematically, illegally searching the students and the citizens who were wearing the red square. People were detained legally for a few hours because they were wearing this political sign also. We see the police being more and more aggressive in the protests, and you know, the the bad thing about having too much protest is that sometimes citizens get used to see police brutality, and that's what's beginning to be in Quebec, because we have, you know, we have protests every day in Montreal. So people are beginning to be used to see police brutality, and it's beginning to be more and more normal.
We've seen these mass demonstrations. You've seen the, you know, alleged attempt at the tuition hike. You've seen the Bill 78, the ending of your school term, and now you've seen what you just described as a massive police presence everywhere and what I would think are completely illegal searches. What's happening right now, and what's the future? I mean, is there another demonstration called? Is there an attempt to repeal the bill? Where's this all going? I mean, you've been at it now for a long time. It's been a massive, like, positive in a certain way for all of us watching to see this in Montreal against austerity and against what you said is worse 10 years of effects of this government. But what's going to happen next?
Well, for the moment, there are two main strategies being used. First, we have a legal strategy. We are currently contesting the law in front of the Court of Quebec. We are trying to suspend the law and to declare it unconstitutional. That's the first thing that we're trying to do. On the mobilization level, we are planning two major protests this summer, one on June 22nd, one on July 22nd. You know, those protests on the 22nd of each month have now began to be really a tradition here since the beginning of the strike. So that's why we are planning that protest, those two major protests. And, you know, because the campus are closed by the Bill 78, it's difficult for us now to go and mobilize the students. So what we have decided to do is to really have a strategy of urban and citizen mobilization. So that's why we will be in the streets of all the cities of the province. We will be in all the major public events, in the subways. We will distribute information, enter in a dialogue with the population in order really to stimulate the support to our cause in the population.
What are the demands that are being put forward by the movement in Quebec?
Well, you know, at the beginning, there was one clear and simple demand that was to stop the increasing of tuition fees that was announced. That was at the beginning. Now it's a little bit more difficult to say because the movement is now so big. There's so much group, so many people in the movement. But it's clear that as student organizations, what we are asking now is still very simple, is to stop increasing tuition fees in Quebec in order to keep our universities accessible to everyone, whatever their socioeconomic status. That's the basic demand. Since the adoption of Bill 78, it's clear that the abrogation of this law is now a demand that is being also more and more heard in the street.
And Gabrielle, as you leave our listeners, if they want more information, is there a website people can go to?
Yeah, you can go on the website of the of our coalition. We have an English version. It's called stopthehike.ca.
Say it again.
Stop the hike.
Stopthehike.ca. Stopthehike.ca. Got it.
Yes. So that's the website of the student associations here who are in strike. So you have information about our demands. You have also the calendar of the activities. You have the samples of our posters, of our newspapers. So it's
exciting for all of us, and congratulations to what you've achieved already.
Gabrielle, you have been a true inspiration, all of you in Canada, to many of us here in New York City. We recently had a Pots and Pans rally in solidarity. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gabrielle.
Good luck.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
elections in Greece have just occurred. We were able to talk just before the elections with Greek-American National Lawyers Guild attorney Eric Poulos. We spoke with him about the left, right, and center parties in Greece, what they stand for, and what his predictions on the outcome of the elections would be.
Eric Poulos, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, Eric, you come to the topic of Greece honestly. You're half Greek. You've been following these things very closely. And we at Law and Disorder want to know what's at stake in Greece. What are the forces in play? What are the political programs that the far left is advancing?
So what we're interested in, as Michael said, is the social forces. And then we'll come back to you next week for what happens in the election. Okay. So right now, this interview is taking place before the election. So give us a sense of why is everybody concerned by it? Why do we care about it? What are the social forces?
Okay, well, that's a tall order. But what is going on in Greece is really just much more acute than what is going on in Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland. And it's the crisis of capitalism throughout Europe and Western world. Greece, it's just more extreme because Greece is in deeper hole. But the problem stems from the fact of the whole banking crisis. Greece has gotten money from the European Union, not to bail out Greece. That's a misnomer in the press. It's to bail out the banks. So the banks are getting money. The overwhelming majority of the loan from the European Union goes to pay off debt service to banks. Very little goes to Greece. So as this happens, there's this spiral that Greece sinks deeper and deeper in debt because of this loan, which in turn is to pay off the banks and is not going to bring Greece out of a depression. In fact, there's no stimulus whatsoever. There's nothing to create jobs. Jobs are being lost. And the unemployment rate is 20 to 25%. Among youths, it's 50%. Greeks are, if they can, are leaving the country, taking their money out of the banks. Pharmacies are not filling prescriptions. Doctors are not getting reimbursed from the state. And in fact, the election workers are threatening to strike, so nobody will be able to count the ballots. So it's a country in deep, deep crisis, and which probably will see acted out in Spain and the other countries very soon, if not already.
Talk to us about the far-left coalition that's formed there, and who makes it up and what they stand for.
Okay, well, there are a number of forces in Greece. Number of the parties call themselves leftists. In fact, the governing party, PASOK, is a social democratic party, whose leader, Andreas Papandreou, was president of the Socialist International. There is a far-left group, Antarsia, which got about 1-2% of the vote, which is presents itself as far left. It's a coalition of far left wing groups, Trotskyist and otherwise, and that has called for a total transformation of Greece and presented what's called transitional demands that deal with the crisis of capitalism, but also try and bring in a socialist alternative. To the right of that is a leading party, which may be the leading vote-getter, called Syriza. And that's what's been in the press. Syriza emerged from the last election. Remember, your listeners should realize this is a runoff election from one that occurred in early May, where there was no clear victor. Syriza is a left-wing party that emerged almost from obscurity to get a large amount of the vote. Well, at least we'll get the largest total in this election. Syriza is made up of many, many forces. It's a coalition.
But, Eric, who's the runoff between? If there was an election in May, who's the runoff between? I mean, you mentioned the parties, the far-left party, the Social Democratic Party, Syriza, but what are they voting for?
Okay, all the parties can and will be in this election. In fact, runoff possibly is a bad term. The parties who were elected, nobody got a majority of any sort. There was an attempt to make a form of government, but they could not agree on that. So Greek law is that without being able to form a government, they have to have new elections.
Right, so these new elections could even result again in many splintered parties getting
that's
votes and not being able to form a government again,
that's
right?
That's absolutely right. It looks like, and it's hard to predict because Greece has a law that you can't publish information about polls 2 weeks within the election. So the last polls were 2 weeks ago, and it looks like the right-wing party might be gaining votes. That's the New Democracy, which is the mainstream conservative party. It also looks like Syriza, which is this left-wing force, might be gaining some votes too. The far-left coalition, it's very possible, will lose votes because people might feel they've got to vote for left-wing party Syriza. It's unclear, but to talk about program, Syriza, which is the left-wing, main left-wing force, which got a large amount of vote, wants to cancel the memorandum which triggered the loan from the EU. It wants a moratorium on the payment of the debt, and it has various measures dealing with corruption, which is a big issue in Greece. It wants to remove immunity.
Let me just stop you for 1 second, because this shows how little I know. There was an agreement about with the EU, and attached to that agreement is something called the memorandum. And the memorandum is the one that imposes all of the austerity measures?
That's right. The memorandum imposes austerity measures, which Greece has tried to fulfill and has resulted in devastation, just devastation. You know, when originally they were negotiating this in 2010, the Prime Minister, Andreas Papandreou, said to Prime Minister of Germany, Merkel, he said, you know, this is really going to hurt. And she said, well, that's good, because it will be a lesson to other countries that if it hurts enough, nobody else will follow Greece's path. So it's clear that the wealthier and the ruling classes of Western Europe knew this would happen, and it's had a devastating impact. So the memorandum which triggered these austerities is not popular in Greece whatsoever. Syriza, the left-wing, main left-wing party, says that they will cancel it if elected. Now, even the mainstream parties which agreed to it, like PASOK, the Social Democrats, say they want to renegotiate that agreement. So there's really almost nobody running in this election upholding that agreement, even those who agreed to it. So it's a very strange kind of situation.
Again, with the demands, Eric, you mentioned transitional demands. What's the far left putting forward in terms of those kind of demands?
Well, the far left is demanding that there be nationalization of the banks, that the work week be lessened with no cut in pay, but spread the jobs around, that there are fewer jobs, that Greece has these huge military contracts with the German and French military defense companies, which Germany and France will not let the Greeks out of those contracts. The far left demand is just unilaterally cancel those contracts, you know, let them come after Greece to pay for battleships when 50% of the youths are out of work. It's more of a fighting platform that really wants to sort of confront these issues. You know, one of the things of the austerity, this shows how bankrupt this austerity plan was to increase sales tax in Greece. Well, to increase sales tax on people out of work buying products is really adding insult to injury. And what needs to be done is a massive increase in income tax on the wealthy and the corporations. The one of the few big industries in Greece is the shipping and ship owning. Those taxes need to be increased. Tremendous progressive income tax on those companies. They've gotten away with paying very little taxes, and that needs to be done. So those are some of the demands the far left is making.
Eric, what about the far right? I've seen predictions that the far right's going to grow, that Greek fascism is on the roll, and I think that's a very frightening prospect. What do you think with respect to that?
The far right is a very alarming prospect. There is an out-and-out fascist party that got almost 7% of the vote, Golden Dawn. Even the mainstream conservative party, New Democracy, which may very well get the most votes, in the last week has started a campaign called We Want to Retake the Streets. It's an anti-immigrant reoccupy the streets. There's a huge anti-immigrant sentiment that these far-right parties have tapped into, and this fascist party has gone so far as to arrange attacks on immigrant centers where they physically attack the immigrants. A reporter for the Jerusalem Post who was covering that got beat up. And even on television, there were representatives of the Communist Party and the left-wing party who were attacked on TV by the fascist representative, who then went into hiding because he's now wanted for arrest. The leader of that party's daughter is wanted for assaulting immigrants. That's the leader of the party. They deny that there was a Holocaust. They have a symbol that's very close to a swastika, and they have great appeal within the military and the police. So it's a very alarming thing. Now, this weekend, there were huge demonstrations throughout Greece against this fascist group, and that's very a good development, an exciting development. The discouraging aspect is that the main left-wing group, Syriza, who may very well get the most votes, did not endorse that anti-fascist demonstration, I think, because they don't want to look too militant. And they are already making noises about the leader, Tsipras, about he's looking forward to coming to Washington and meeting President Obama, and what he wants to do in Greece is what Obama did in the United States. That is both stimulation of the economy along with austerity. So they are moving very rapidly to the right.
We're going to come back to you next week to get the update on what happens in the election. But very briefly, what's your prediction?
Syriza's popularity has increased tremendously. Since the election where the polls showed they were popular among about 30%, the last poll 2 weeks ago, their popularity is at 50%. It's very hard to tell. I think New Democracy, the mainstream conservative party, is basically well-liked by the EU and the media and the ruling classes. I think they might even do a little better than their... they got 20% in the last election. I would not be surprised if they do better. I think Syriza might do better. The Social Democrats, PASOK, I think are stuck. They're not going to increase. And then the only thing is there are a number of splinter groups in the middle, very moderate left-wing, moderate right-wing. The issue is, can they form a coalition government? I don't believe anybody will get a majority. And the issue will be, will those other groups form a coalition government with New Democracy? Syriza, the left-wing party, has actually said it would form a coalition if the parties renounce the agreement. They'd even form a coalition government with right-wing parties. I don't think they can afford to do that because the EU, the penalties will just be too severe. If you want my prediction, which is not foolproof at all, I think the conservatives will gain. I think Syriza, the left-wing groups, will gain. I think the smaller, tinier parties possibly will lose. And unfortunately, the far-left party, which got almost 2%, is probably going to lose votes, too. And the real story is, how much does the election even mean in terms of Greece's future?
Well, thank you, Eric. We'll be coming back to you next week for a update after the election. And thanks. It was great.
Okay.
Appreciate
my pleasure.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eric.
Okay. Bye, Eric.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
The Cuban Five were convicted 14 years ago this month on conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future. Recently, prominent First Amendment attorney Martin Garbus joined the case of the five. He's concentrating his legal efforts on the U.S. government-paid journalists in Miami who received hundreds of thousands of dollars in payments from the Office of Cuba Broadcasting, a fact unknown to the Cuban Five defense at the time of the trial. The reporters covered the case in an almost hysterical and highly prejudicial fashion. Joining us today is Martin Garbus to talk about the case and a recent motion that he filed for information in federal court. Martin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Last week, you filed a motion for evidentiary hearing and discovery with the federal judge. That was Judge
right.
Leonard,
right.
Who was the trial judge. What does that mean for our listeners?
It means that we're trying to get all of the facts nailed down on the paid journalism or paid agents issue. The motion is to get discovery of those facts and then to proceed to the hearing to reverse the convictions. What we have been doing for the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years is through various legal proceedings trying to get these facts, and we have failed to do it. The government resists at every point with respect to the kind of information we're trying to get.
Assuming that the facts come in and say that the government was paying journalists to paint the Cuban Five in Miami in a very bad light, if that happens, then where do you go from there?
Well, I think it's more than a bad light. I think that there's a shoot down, and the first set of indictments are not don't come down until 15 or 16 months. And presumably, there's a great deal of public pressure going back and forth. Should they be indicted? Shouldn't they be indicted? Then after the first set of indictments come down, 7 months later, you have the conspiracy to murder indictments come down. So what you have is a cauldron when this is in the public debate about, so it's not just the question of the media being influenced, it's not just the question of the jury pool being saturated, it's not just the question of the jurors themselves being saturated, but, and we understand that the government was paying people who were on major newspapers, major media, substantial sums of money to write stories, to get indictments, as well as convictions, and to influence the whole question of how you charge people. In a normal world, these defendants would not have been charged with the kinds of things they were charged, given the facts and circumstances of this case. So it's not just the question of the media affecting the jury pool. It goes long before that. And what the Supreme Court holds, as we all know, although there's a, it sets a constitutional standard if you're dealing with issues like guilt and innocence, but there's also a standard when the material you're trying to get at here does not directly relate to guilt or innocence, but it's a horrific constitutional violation.
Would that be interfering, tampering? What would it be called?
To the extent that we can show, the allegation is, it's perfectly logical to assume that given the politics of the time, given the Gonzalez case, given the shootdown, et cetera, one would expect the prosecutor to do all they could, and one would expect the prosecutor to try and justify and get the highest kind of charges they could at anybody that they could get. Now, there's no reason why they waited X period of time. The government fundamentally knew where these people were. These governments fundamentally could have picked them up on or about the time of the shootdown. So one question is why? Why are they waiting 16 months? And what are the political factors? What's the conversation going on between State Department, to the extent that we can find out, and the Department of Justice over this kind of stuff? What it is government influence at every single part of the legal process.
Now, Marty, to make it clear to our listening audience, some of whom may not be that familiar with the Cuban Five case, the Cuban Five were convicted for conspiracy to commit espionage sometime in the future. They were down in Miami. They had been sent by the Cuban government to keep tabs on these terrorists in Miami who were committing crimes against people and property in Cuba, particularly in Havana, targeting the tourist industry. And the Cuban Five were trying to figure out what these terrorists were going to do and alert the government in Havana to it. And the United States figured out who the Cuban Five were. And instead of arresting the terrorists in Miami, they arrested the Cuban Five. And you're talking about how they arrested them 16 months later after a shootdown of an overflight of planes that were launched from Miami to Havana to drop leaflets on Havana. Continue on why this is such an egregious violation of constitutional rights to have government pay reporters.
You said it wonderfully. As you were talking, 37 things went into my head and have now long since gone out. I think that the way the government went about this case, the way the government dealt with issues like where was the shootdown, where wasn't the shootdown, there was cooperation going on between Cuba at a government-to-government level, between Cuba and the American government, to deal with the question of the Miami terrorists, let's call them that. Bill Richardson made a statement. Clinton had said there would be no more planes flying down over Cuba because everybody realized that was an explosive, inflammatory situation. So what you had were the Cuban government and the American government by the various representatives trying to stop the Cuban terrorists who had blown up Havana Hotel, who had been involved in a plane shootdown, who had, Posada Corrales, some people involved, who everyone recognized were criminals. You had both governments trying to defang a very bad situation. So the way you put it, I think, is appropriate. Instead of stopping, once they're learning that the planes are going down, instead of stopping the planes, they chose 16, 17 months later to arrest these five people whose names they knew because that was part of the cooperation pact. and there was absolutely no reason to do it. It was just a switch. And if you get into the details of the case with respect to the FBI, with respect to how information went from various governmental agencies, there were many people in Miami who did not like the idea of the Cuban government and the American government, through government representatives, trying to cut back the Miami terrorists. What happened is a lot of them became kind of rogue agents and trying to blow up that whole thing and trying to ruin whatever kind of cooperation there was. So you had this political situation going on as to what these guys should be charged with. But there was a recognition by all sides, not of course the extreme right Cubans, that the extreme right Cubans posed a threat in the past, posed a present threat, and posed a future threat. And Richardson gave the assurance that Clinton would not let any more planes go down. It seems apparent that it was a purely political prosecution, and it's very easy to have a political prosecution at that time, given Gonzalez, given the fact that four people are dead. And to get a conviction of these guys was the easiest thing in the world.
Martin, I want to bring us back to the recent appeal. The prosecutor says they didn't know of the payments to the journalists and that the Justice Department couldn't possibly know that the State Department was paying Miami. Your motion answers that specific claim by the government. Can you tell us what it says?
It's inconceivable. Inconceivable. The one department of government did not know what the other department of government was doing in a case where everybody or many, many people within the government had the same goal. You just had people going down a direct path. There was no reason from the American government's viewpoint not to uphold a conviction, allegedly, for the horrendous killing of four people and then drawing that picture at the same time they were drawing a picture of the Cuban government. And at the same time, they're drawing a picture of what was going on in the Gonzalez case. Without saying what you or I or anyone else would do, but if you were sitting in the shoes of the prosecutor or in the shoes of the Department of State, there can be no question how all of your goals were satisfied by this result. Now, will we find a smoking gun? I don't know. There's a reason why the government has been withholding documents.
Yes, exactly.
For 5, 6, 7 years. Presumably there's something there. Now, will we be able to get somebody on the stand and say, I had this conversation with State? I don't know. But I think also government people, you put 30 government people on, if we can get that many people, and there's just so much lying or bending evidence that you can do. It is so logical that this was done. There'd be no reason not to expect it to be done. If you and I were zealots at whatever goals we had and we were trying to achieve a result, this is exactly what we would do. But whatever it is, you see the consequences of public pressure always. And for the prosecutor, there's no prosecutor that doesn't manipulate, very few prosecutors that don't manipulate public attention in domestic cases. And here the stakes are so much higher.
I wanted to ask you about Gerardo Hernandez, who is serving a double life sentence. How do you see the prospects for his freedom?
I see it keyed to this. This is the only thing that can work. As I have now gone through the evidence, and as I have now, I started with Lenny Wineglass maybe 10 years ago when this first started to simmer, and then it exploded in the Miami Herald report in 2006. I don't know of any other case where you're going to get this accumulation of facts in a situation which is as explosive as this, given the politics, the traditional historical politics, as well as what was going on at that time. It was a tinderbox. The fact that a three-judge court could decide the motion for change of venue was wrongly denied is incredible. That tells you you're at the tip of a ledge and that there must be a great deal more. Now, of course, the en banc court reversed that. That's an enormous step forward. That's telling you there's something there. You had two judges saying that this was a firestorm. I don't know where you'll ever get a case that will be any better than this one, if I can use that word.
Well, Marty Garbus, we're so glad and relieved that with Lenny's death that you've stepped in to be part of the Cuban Five team.
Thank you.
We thank you for your update on this, and we wish you a lot of luck with your motion to get this stuff about collaboration between the government and the press down in Miami out in the open so the public can see it. Thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thank you, Marty, and I wanted to share what Michael said. It's great to have you on the Cuban Five case.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.